People say, oh, I'm systematic, I'm 100% systematic, and I say that as well. But if you really step back and think about it, no one's really 100% systematic. You have to say that you're wrong. You have to take your loss, you have to admit that you're wrong. And, I, for whatever reason, never really had too much of a problem with that. I think a lot of people mistakenly think that quant finance and systems trading is like just a data science and coding game. And he's like, he meaning the salesperson, is just fuming. Like, he is going to kill me, right? And I'm thinking, like, my career on Wall Street is done before it starts. I mean, this guy's going to hate me forever. Like, I'm going to be out on the street, another victim of the financial crisis, all this stuff. What you quickly learn as a market maker is that there is so many different motivations and reasons for an institution or whomever to do a trade. And at the end of the day, if a big guy is doing a trade, they're going to move the prices, and that's it.
Welcome to the Everyman Podcast, the podcast which explores trading and investing through the lens of the personal and human aspects of performance. We explore themes such as trading psychology, behavior, mindset, and many of the intangible aspects which underpin success in financial markets. The Everyman Podcast is delighted to be associated with the Society of Technical Analysts. The STA. The STA is one of the world's leading and most respected bodies which trains and accredits members of the trading and investment community in the practice of technical analysis. Today, we are delighted to welcome Chris Kane. Chris is a private trader, former market maker, and co-author with Larry Connors of a new book, The Alpha Formula, High-Powered Strategies to Beat the Market with Less Risk. This is a great interview which covers a huge range of themes, so please sit back and enjoy this week's podcast. Welcome to the Everyman Podcast. My name is Stephen Goldstein. My usual co-host, Mark Randall, cannot be with us today, and that is my fault. I managed to mess up today's timings for the call. But we have a great guest today. His name is Chris Kane. Chris is the author of a new book called The Alpha Formula, Beat the Market with Significantly Less Risk. Now, Chris is more than just an author. Chris has spent 10 years as a market maker at INTL FC Stone, where he traded and ran risk in various US government and associated interest rate and fixed income products. Chris also trades for himself and is currently ranked in the top 40 traders on the fundseeder.com platform. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe that puts him in the top 0.5% of traders on verified performance. So Chris is really someone who's been there, done that, got the t-shirt, and now has also written a book. So welcome, Chris, to the podcast.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Maybe you can start by telling the audience a little bit about yourself, your background, and your history in this business.
Sure, absolutely. Sure. So my background, my interest in trading was sparked in college. I've always been a big reader. That's always really helped me. Market Wizards and other books really sparked my interest in college. So I knew I wanted to go down this path. Was a finance major. I got a job right out of university as a government bond trader at a boutique government bond dealer called GX Clark. Like many traders, I started, especially in the fixed income world, I started in the short end of the curve. So my first job was trading short-term government bonds, U.S. Treasury bills, etc. When you first start, they start you with the low duration stuff because it's kind of like trading with training wheels in a way. So I had a 10-year career there. I won't bore you with all the things that I traded throughout this time, but suffice to say, I naturally moved out the curve as I got more experience and was able to take more risk for the firm. I also moved out the risk curve, so I didn't just trade government bonds. I traded other types of bonds as well, swaps, Eurodollar futures, etc. My specialty became what's called U.S. agency bonds, so that's Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac bonds. That became my specialty, especially the longer end of that curve. So that was what I really specialized in. Towards the end of my career. During this time, GX Clark got bought by a bigger firm called INTL FC Stone. What was GX Clark, which was only a sales and trading operation, basically became the sales and trading fixed income operation for INTL FC Stone. So that is my 2 second professional background. During this time though, I always was very interested in trading for my own account and such. I was always inspired by the systematic way of trading. That was always what resonated with me, even back in college. When I read Market Wizards, I read Joel Greenblatt's book, The Little Book That Beats the Market, and others. It really resonated with me, the fact that you could have these systematic rules and you could let the computer tell you what to do and all that kind of stuff. So, I was always enthralled by that. It took many years to find a systematic strategy that really worked for me and I thought had a high probability of success. I'm a pretty risk-averse person, so for many years, even as trading was my professional job, I basically just sat in cash for my own personal capital because I was, again, unsure what to do. I didn't really have a strategy that fit me. So my first trend following systematic strategy that I applied to the FX markets began trading in 2013, and then I have since moved on to add several different strategies to my portfolio, including cross asset based momentum type strategies, trading ETFs. I have a factor model that I call quantamentals that trades individual equities. I have a long short equity strategy that's more of a mean reversion type strategy, fixed income strategies, and others as well. So that's my background in a nutshell, Stephen.
Okay, that's fascinating, and there's a lot of questions which I'd love to ask you based on that. And of course, we're going to move on to your book at some point. The first thing well, there's a few things that came up there. The first thing is the term systematic trading, because so many people, I mean, this is a very generic term, and so many people use it, and yet I've worked with so many people who do use it, and when I speak to them, they all have different versions of it. So what exactly do you mean when you use the term systematic trading?
That's a great question. What I mean, and again, what I was always attracted to is, what I always wanted was in the heat of the moment, during the day, what you're gonna do. So, you're gonna run the code whenever, the time that you have to rebalance or however your system is structured, and you're going to follow the instructions that the computer tells you to do. So that's what I mean by systematic trading. But you bring up a good point. I mean, people say, oh, I'm systematic, I'm 100% systematic, and I say that as well. But if you really step back and think about it, no one's really 100% systematic because there's always discretion that comes into it, right? You have to decide what strategies you're going to trade. You have to decide, the capital or the risk allocation to each strategy, how your portfolio is set up, when to turn things off, when to turn things on, when to determine if a strategy isn't working anymore, et cetera. So, there's always a bit of discretion in setting up your process, but the actual process on a day-to-day basis is completely systematic with no discretionary overrides. So that's what I mean by systematic trading.
Yeah, and I mean, you make a really great point there about the process still involving lots of discretion, and that discretion is often at different places in that process. I've just finished the new book about Jim Simons, The Man Who Sold the Market, by Gregory Zuckerman, and what amazed me sort of reading it, and I don't know if you've had a chance to read it yet, it's a brilliant book, was actually how much discretion there is in the process. And there was a point towards the end of the book where they were talking about what was known as a quant quake, where basically all the systems, all the big funds were pointing in the same direction, and they were all cratering performance over the space of 24 hours. And they had to make a decision whether to override the system and reduce their risk. And it sounds like it was a ve you know it was a big I mean it was a huge decision for them, and it was a very controversial decision within the firm. And Jim Simmons made the decision to override the risk because he said, at the end of the day, we need to stay alive. What happened was actually the markets came back, But he said he would do the same thing again tomorrow. The number one thing is your fund has to stay alive. There's always a risk of margin calls, of your positions being forced to be closed. There's always events which are outside your control. And I
Yes.
mean, that's one example. But, as you said, the processes that are chosen, the way you do them, the way you manage. What about the way you actually trade? Do you actually physically put the trade on, or are they selected for you?
So, I follow the system to a T. So, I want to basically, I'm a big believer in if you do all the research, you do all the back testing, you're happy with the back test, and there's many caveats that go into that as far as overfitting and et cetera. But those issues aside, if you've decided that you want to trade like this, you want to have these type of results that the back test is showing, then you just follow the system to a letter. So, I don't know if this was exactly your question, but I'm not completely automated in the sense that I'm just pushing a button and all the trades happen. I still do get, a printout, if you will, of orders that need to go in, and then I put the orders in myself. I have the ability to automate everything. I actually have done that as an exercise, but I do like that human touch, if you will, just because I like to see what positions are being put on, which are being closed out, where my exposures are. And I've learned this as a market maker. You could look at the market all you want and try to get a feel for it and everything, but once you have a position, once you actually do the trade, it's much easier to have that feel and have that a sense of what's going on. So I do keep that human element. I don't override anything. I just do what the computer tells me to do, but I do put the trades in myself. But your other comment about the Jim Simons book, I thought that book was awesome. And it was so eye-opening. I mean, some of the things that you said, I could just elaborate on. Those guys are obviously the pinnacle of our business, and their results are just mind-blowing. So they always were held to a high pedestal, and I've obviously known about them for many years, but that book really humanized them. I mean, from that story that you just told to the other story about Jim Simons basically, having a little panic in Q4 last year when the market was melting down, and he called his financial advisor, all the way back to when he started, which he started as just a I don't want to degrade it at all, but you would think a brilliant mathematician like himself, he would have went right into quant, right into models, all that kind of stuff, but he didn't. He was trading the news and trading discretionary and gut feel, and that was just really, it really humanized them. I thought that the book was fantastic.
No, that's great. And that's what I felt about the book. Greg Zuckerman told the story and of each character. And actually, I'm delighted to say Greg's going to be on the podcast in January, so I'll get a chance to ask him to explore that with him a little bit more. But that's what jumped out at me was that was the how human it was, realizing that it wasn't overnight success. It was 10 to 12 years of struggling before they finally hit on something. And then, for me, Simons, he was there with a vision. He had that vision all along. He did every now and then pull away from it and then come back to it. But he was as much to me, it sounded like he was an inspiration for all the people, and it was a huge team effort. He brought these brilliant mathematicians on board, but it was almost his guiding vision which gave them, which directed them in a way that made it such a, or has made it such a great success.
Oh yeah, I mean that book made me, have even more respect for him than I already had. I mean, Stephen, you probably know this by, working with so many traders, and I work with a lot of traders and quants and all this stuff, and people are brilliant, right? But a lot of brilliant people, it's hard for them to, build a team. It's hard for them to collaborate. It's hard for them, they think, okay, I have a secret sauce. I'm so smart. I'm just gonna do this and not share my information. And Jim Simons seemed to be the opposite of that. He really brought smart people together, gave them free rein to make the models and to make them better. And he didn't seem like a big egomaniac. And that was one of the things. I always knew he was a great trader, a great mathematician, But as a team builder and as a leader, I didn't know he had those skills that he certainly has. So it was a very interesting read.
Yeah, I mean that's almost a gift. You know, it's you know, it's not just his quant gift. I mean, I'm fortunate that, you know, I've worked in trading firms nearly 20, well, over 20 years actually, nearly 25 years as a trader. So I've seen it all on the inside. And now I work with firms as an external, a coach. I go in as a coach, but I work with a number of firms. And I go into many, I go into investment banks, energy firms, hedge funds, and I get to see who's doing it right and who's struggling. And often it's the human side they're getting right. It's not the intellectual side. And there was a great quote, it's by a guy called Brian Keating, who's a physicist based in California. The quote is, "Scientists are human, often all too human. When desire and data are in collision, evidence sometimes loses out to emotion." And that is so true. That quote really jumped out at me from the book, because we see this time and time again. And on the podcast a few weeks ago, we had a behavioral scientist called Benis Kumar. Benis told us of work that he's been called in to do with funds, where the funds have said, "Our problem is we've got these great systems, fund management systems, you know, sort of investment systems, stock picking systems, but our PMs are overriding them, and we need you to help us with that. You know, they don't trust the system, and that is our problem." And you know that, you know, he said to me, "How, as a behavioral scientist, can I come in to a quant fund? Why are you calling me in?" And he said, "Well, our problem is human, you know." And this is the challenge, and this is where I think a lot of people fail to understand financial markets.
That's so interesting. That is so interesting. And I mean, I've seen that firsthand as well. A couple of things. I mean, I'm thinking about, just because you were speaking about it, and I am as well, quantitative systems and systematic strategies. I'm just such a big believer in doing the research yourself. Because trading is hard, and it's going to knock you on your butt, and it's going to cause you self-doubt, and it's going to you're going to have bad days, bad weeks, bad months, maybe bad years. So if you don't know what's really in this strategy, really in this system, if you haven't picked it apart, if you haven't stress tested it, if you haven't coded it, if you haven't, then it's so easy to override, or so easy to think, "I know better than the strategy." So that's why, even if you're doing something like that you know works, like let's just say trend following, most people would agree that trend following over time, over decades, has worked. But putting together a trend following strategy yourself from the ground up really lets you know all the bells and whistles, all the nuts and bolts of the strategy. And to me, it makes it less likely that you override it, because you really built it, you know why it's doing exactly what it's doing. And that's why I think, when people buy systems from other people or follow other people's advice, it could be great advice, but I'm a little leery of that, because I can give someone a great system, that's looks great on a back test and isn't over optimized and all this stuff, but it's going to have bad days, it's going to have bad weeks. If you don't really know the thought process behind it, if you don't really know all the code and what's going on and why it's doing what it's doing, you're probably going to override it, and you're probably not going to get the results that you quote unquote should. So it's very important, in my opinion, to do your own research and not just rely on other people.
And you know, that is so true. And there was something else. I'm going to go back to you because it's connected to that point you said about you like to actually get the trades and put them on yourself, because it allows you to understand the trades the system is putting on for you, and it gives you a sense of where your exposure is. For me, more than anything, it gives you a feel. I mean, I used to I wasn't a systematic trader. Not in a pure sense. I did use, you know, I think everyone is in some way systematic, even if they're discretionary. They're trading some sort of system which is in their head. But it's that point about feeling the market. Jim Simon's product came out of, you know, a decade of being in the market and feeling it, you know,
Yep.
and it didn't just happen overnight. And he came to learn what the market's really like and then brought that into the work they were doing. And I always, when I traded, I always liked to have a very small exposure to the market, even if I didn't have a strong view. Because, you know, for me, it was like, you know, I have to be in, I use a fishing analogy, I have to be in the water to know where the fish are biting before I could put my
Yep.
rod in there. And
Yep.
if I wasn't in it and I wasn't feeling it and I wasn't getting small wins and small losses and surprise moves, you know, it doesn't impact you the same if you're just looking at it. But
Totally. Totally.
for me, that was an important part. So I completely understand why you're doing that. And I've got another someone I work with who has built an incredible day trading system, and it fully automates, it fully executes the whole time. But he looks at it the whole time, and he you know, he has a record of every trade that comes up when it executes, and he follows that trade, even if, you know, because I mean, he was a discretionary trader formerly, and he likes to see what it does. And he says that, you know, that allows him to look at the system and to understand its quirks, even though he's designed it. Till you actually follow it, you're not quite sure how it's going to work in certain market conditions. And it's allowed him to actually calibrate and improve it over time.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with that more. I mean, a couple of things. What you just said is what I was going to say. I mean, me manually putting in the trades, like I said, I don't override anything, and it's a very slow process for me to ever change the strategies. You know, it has to take months of testing and all this kind of stuff. But my strategies did improve because I did that, because I put in the trades, I know what's going on, and then maybe an idea would spark and say, you know what? Maybe if I did this instead, that might, be more congruent with what I'm trying to achieve here. Again, it takes months of testing to actually implement that, but without that human touch, I would have never gotten that idea. So that's very important. And another thing you said, I could take that back to when I was a market maker. I remember when I first started, so I had the kind of unfortunate thing to start in June 2008. That's when I was my first day on the job.
I can
So it's like
outdo
the
that, but we'll come back in a second.
okay. So yeah, so that was my first day on the job. So the next couple months, obviously the world falls apart. Luckily for me, I wasn't actually taking any risk at that point. I was just a trader's assistant, if you will. But I remember being a trader's assistant, and without naming any names, the trader that I was tasked to be his assistant, would ask me, we had all these different bond positions, right? And all these different issues. And he would say, where do we buy this? Where do we sell this? Like, what's our cost basis here? What's our cost basis there? And I would never be able to remember, and he would always know. He would say, we bought this at par 11 and we sold this at 102.5 and whatever, right? And I was like, wow, this guy's just like so smart. And he's just a genius, and I don't know how he remembers all this stuff, and I'm never going to be able to do this. And it was really in my mind. And then as soon as you just get your own risk and get your own book, and you're the one giving the bids and offers, and you're the ones getting hit and all this kind of stuff, you remember. As soon as you have skin in the game, as soon as your salesperson says you're filled here, you're getting lifted here, you're going to remember what that price is, and it's going to be pretty effortless. So it's to your point of dipping your toes in the water and having, some type of skin in the game, it really helps from that perspective.
Totally, totally. And I was just saying that my first week of trading, my first ever position went on the 2nd week of October 1987.
Wow. Wow.
Baptism by fire is a great way to learn.
Me and you, Stephen, same thing.
But actually, I think yours may have been bigger actually, because mine was just really a one day event in the end, whereas yours was it was day after day, week after week. So
Day after
I
day,
think
and
I
I
take
knew it was
my
a
hat
big
off to you.
deal.
You acted me.
Yeah, I knew it was a big deal at the time, but like looking back on it, especially like the moves in the bond markets, it was. Now with all my experience, I could really put it into perspective and see how crazy, 2008 really was, especially with the, short-term interest rate market stresses and all that kind of stuff. It was very something that, we're going to maybe talk about anchoring and confirmation bias and stuff a little later. I mean, that is something that will never leave me. I will always think about 2008. That'll be forever ingrained in my career just because of when it started. So I'm sure you're similar with 1987.
And the moment you have your first screw up, you learn more in that than you will in basically in reading 1,000 books. Because you feel it so deeply.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, perhaps, I've got so many questions, but I know at the start of your book, you talk about an incident
Yeah.
where you had something
Yeah.
around that. Maybe you can just sort of, because this would be great for the audience to relate to that. Maybe you could just sort of tell us about that.
Sure, absolutely. So, the book, we can get into it a little later, but it's a lot about behavior, and building strategies around human behavior. So I start the book out with a true story. So, as I said, I started in June 2008. So this story took place in the heart of the crisis. So this would have been October 2008. So, like I said, I started in the short-term desk, trading what we called money markets, as well as, and that includes, treasury bills and other short-term government debt. So, no one tells you, in school or when you first start that like negative interest rates could be a thing, right? Now it's like all of Europe has negative interest rates, but back then it was like a crazy thing to think. So, the guy that I was being an assistant for, he was actually out for the day, which was a heck of a day to be out. And it was at the heart of the crisis. I can't remember the exact day. I don't know if you remember this. They were like voting on the TARP bill, I believe, and at first Congress, voted it down and the market panicked and all this stuff. So we had a big client that came in, remain nameless, but one of the biggest asset managers in the world came in during this time and said, can you offer a huge size of treasury bills, a couple hundred million. And we were a relatively small firm. That's a big trade for us. It's kind of a big trade for anyone, really. And
When they say you offer, they're looking to sell, are they?
they're looking to buy.
They're looking to
They're
buy.
saying,
Okay.
they're saying, what is my price to sell, right? What's my offer? So they're looking to buy. So they're obviously, hurting into the safety of US government debt, right? Because again, the world is falling apart at this time. So they come in and say, please offer X hundred million of this treasury bill, whatever. So, I'm sweating. I'm 22 years old. The guy, the real trader that I'm covering for is out, and he was very senior. And this, not only that, the salesperson that's covered this account is basically the biggest account in the firm. This is the biggest salesperson in the firm. He had a very, very strong personality, someone you did not want to get on your bad side, all this stuff, right? So I look at the screen, and you look at the broker screens and see where it's offered, and it was offered at basically zero. I mean, very, very low interest rate. And that's just a crazy thing to think in the beginning. So I'm thinking, okay, should I offer it there? And then what you have to do when you're a bond trader is what's called, check the repo markets, the funding markets, because if you sell this bond, you have to borrow it and there's a cost associated with that. So I asked the funding guys, what's the interest rate for to borrow this bond for a couple of days? And it was very prohibitive. And again, you could imagine why, because the funding markets were just very stressed at that time. So the bottom line was, it's going to cost us a lot, to borrow this bond until I can cover the short. So, you do the math, and I had a spreadsheet, and that came out to a negative interest rate. I think it was negative 15 basis points. Offer was like quote unquote correct offer. Now I'm going to tell the largest salesperson in the firm with the biggest customer in the firm that I'm going to sell them hundreds of millions of dollars of treasury bills at negative interest rates, which is just unheard of at the time. So I'm like, shaking like a leaf. I tell the guy, my offer is, minus 15 basis points. And, he looks at me like he's gonna just rip my head off. Like, he's like, there is no way I'm going back to this client and telling them that we're gonna sell, we offer to sell them these bonds at negative interest rates. You cannot sell bonds at negative interest rates. Our system can't even handle it. We're not even set up to put that ticket in. Like, you're out of your mind. Like, you were just in college 6 months ago. Like, get the heck out of here, So I'm like, listen, this is where they're offered on screen. This is what the repo guys tell me the rate is. Here's the math. Here's why, I'm trying to protect the firm. Here's why the offer is what it is. And he was just having none of it. He was like, you must be making a mistake. I am not calling them back and telling them this. Like, you go F yourself, So this quickly got escalated. The head of trading, the head of sales, me and the salesperson all got in a room. I told everyone what was going on. I told them the math. I walked them through it. It got determined that basically this was the quote unquote correct offer given the crazy circumstance that was happening. And he's like, he meaning the salesperson, is just fuming. Like, he is going to kill me, right? And I'm thinking, like, my career on Wall Street is done before it starts. I mean, this guy's gonna hate me forever. Like, I'm gonna be out on the street, another victim of the financial crisis, all this stuff. So, go back to the desk. I see him, like, pacing, not calling the guy back. And I'm like, oh my God, like, what's gonna go on here? So I finally hear him call the guy back, and he's like talking. He was had a big, loud, booming voice. And usually you could hear him in the trading floor, even above everyone. And he's talking very sheepishly here. Like, I can't even hear what he's saying. And he has his chin down by his chest, and he's talking to the client. He must be telling them, our offer is minus 15 basis points. I hear him say, like, basically start stuttering, and I'm like, oh my God, this customer definitely just told us to go F ourselves, So he finally puts his telephone on his shoulder and looks at me and says, you're done. That we actually did this trade at a negative yield, and I just sold hundreds of millions of dollars to the most, one of the most sophisticated asset managers in the world at a negative interest rate. And that taught me a lot. I mean, it taught me that the market could become crazy irrational, that things that people never thought could happen can certainly happen. It also gave me confidence that I was quote unquote right, even though it sounded so crazy, it was actually the right offer. And it was a whole fiasco to cover that trade. That's another story. But yeah, it was certainly baptism by fire.
We interrupt this podcast at roughly the 38.2% point of the podcast to talk briefly about how delighted we are to be associated with the Society of Technical Analysts, or STA, as they're more commonly known. The STA are one of the world's leading bodies for training and educating investment specialists and traders from around the world. They run distance learning and outstanding in-house diploma programs delivered at such prestigious universities as Queen Mary University of London, King's College, and the London School of Economics. To learn more about their education and training programs and diplomas, go to sta-uk.org. Now back to the podcast. As you're telling that, I'm thinking this is great for the audience, because one of the purposes behind, the Alpha Mind podcast was to help people understand more about financial markets, the emotional side, the psychological side, the behavioral side, the intangible side. And also to help open them up a little bit, because there's a lot of private retail traders, and they don't know what it's like inside the firms, and they have this kind of illusion, I think. It's easy inside there that you have all the information, all the news flow, the inside track, and that, if I could just find out what's going on inside the firm, it'll help me understand. And I'll start succeeding in the markets externally, but that's not how it is. So it can help shine a light on what exactly is going on in there for them, hopefully. I mean, a lot of people. We had some great feedback on the interview with Nick Smith last week, who worked in Goldman's and Citibank in the FX markets. But a few people actually came back to us and said, it would have been nice to have tried to understand a little bit more about what it's like on the inside. So, and I mean, maybe you can just illuminate that a little bit for the listeners out there, just to give them a sense of what it's like being a trader, inside. It is an advantage. I'm not going to pretend it's not. It's a huge advantage because you learn so much. But, what is it like, in your opinion, on the inside compared to the outside?
Yes, Stephen. I mean that's a great point. I mean I think a lot of retail traders, as you said, think, oh, you work at a big institution and you just have these huge advantages and you basically, for a lot for in so many words, know what's going to happen before it's going to happen and have the news before everyone else and have all these channels. That's not really true. I mean that wasn't my experience at least. Again, I started in 2008, maybe in the 80s it was different or something, but we all had Bloomberg terminals. Everyone saw the news the same time as everyone else. So it's not like you have these huge advantages that retail doesn't. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say you have no advantages. I mean, you certainly see the order flow, which is an advantage. So that's one advantage. You have, technology, which is advanced, and that's an advantage as well. But one other thing I would say about trading in an institution and being in the market maker, it really teaches you about the market really fast. I mean, one of the things that it taught me right away was that, when you come into the market, you want to say, you want to look at what happened overnight, and you want to see, what Europe's doing, what the bonds are doing, what gold's doing, whatever, and you want to have a story. You just want to say, okay, gold's up because of this, and bonds are down because of that. What you quickly learn as a market maker is that there is so many different motivations and reasons for an institution or whomever to do a trade. And at the end of the day, if a big guy is doing a trade, they're going to move the prices, and that's it. And no matter what the reason is as to why they're doing this transaction, that's going to move the prices. So that immediately made me stop trying to put a narrative to every single market wiggle. I mean, I knew if, a big mutual fund or a huge asset manager was coming in and was going to say, Chris, give me a bid. So they're selling, right? They're saying, Chris, give me a bid on blah, blah, blah bond. They're probably not just going to me. They're going to other people on Wall Street, and they probably have stuff behind it. And that price is going to move down. Now, it doesn't matter what the reason is why they're selling. It could be fundamental, could be technical. Maybe they had a redemption. Maybe the PM just woke up on the wrong side of the bed. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. That price is going down and nothing's going to stop it. And you don't really know why. So that's one thing that being a market maker really taught me right away, was to stop trying to put a narrative to every market wiggle. And that if a big enough guy or, institution, whatever, is selling, that thing's going to go down. If a big enough person is buying, that thing's going to go up. And that's just exacerbated if you have a illiquid market as well. So, that's one of those things that, you could see as a market maker that the market will do whatever it wants based on the flow. And, it's not exactly a rational reason every time.
No, that's great. That's great. And I've experienced that myself. And whenever I try and attach a narrative to something, it always seems to get in the way. For me, historically, I look back on my career and I look at some of my best trades and my worst trades, and some of my best trades really had no narrative. I just followed the market and went with what it's doing. And some of my worst trades were where I had this strong belief that something was going to happen and that XYZ was going to lead to this and that. And it completely messed me up. So there's a huge, huge truth in what you say.
Absolutely. And I found that this is more prohibitive with people that are like, let's say, smarter than me. I found that very, very smart people, especially, if you go to an Ivy League school or this and that, always want to attach a reason as to why things are happening. And it's very difficult for them to just accept that the market's going up because it's going up, and you should probably just get long and stop overthinking it. That's very hard for them to square away. And a related thing, and I've seen this in my career, a lot of, again, people that have very high academic prowess and all this kind of stuff, it's hard for them to be traders because at the end of the day, as a trader, you have to say that you're wrong. You have to take your loss, you have to admit that you're wrong. And I, for whatever reason, never really had too much of a problem with that. It doesn't take that much convincing for me to say that I'm wrong. Whereas someone else, will fight it all day. They'll say, I'm not wrong, the market's wrong, the market's just not seeing what I'm seeing, it'll come around. And those guys and girls just don't really last because, the market can just do whatever it's gonna do, in the short term, and you can fight it all you want, but then you're gonna lose all your money and get fired. So, it's not about being right. It's about being in sync with the market. And it's and again, and another thing is, it's not like if you have a trade that makes money, you're smart, and if you have a trade that loses money, you're dumb. People have to stop thinking that too, because you have to just be in sync with the market and put your ego aside.
You've come up with a number of things that are key to my philosophy around trading. I won't go through the whole thing, but one of them for me is the ability to live with uncertainty, and to live with it in a huge sense. And this isn't something I've just got from my own trading experiences. This is something I've got from the coaching work and the people I've worked with over many years. That the more I notice people are comfortable with uncertainty and are able to lose the attachment to outcomes and are able to divorce their ego from that, the more likely they are to succeed. They're the people that could just turn around and say, I was wrong, move on, next trade. And that is incredibly hard for people to do. And as you say, it seems to be harder the more academic achievement you've got in your life. But there does seem to be something about that. Because it's almost like, you've always had to be right to succeed. And suddenly you're going into a world where, what, I'm going to succeed by admitting I'm wrong.
Absolutely. It is not natural for people. And the irony, Stephen, is that, like, C students aren't getting these jobs, right? Not these days, right? It's like the straight A students are getting the jobs, and I was always very good in school and all this kind of stuff. And so every, a lot of, and here I'm specifically talking about, quote unquote, sell side market makers, that type of thing. You have to have a very high academic pedigree to even get the job, right? So all these people that come in have been the smartest guy or girl in the room, or the smartest in fourth grade, or the smartest in ninth grade, or the smartest in college, et cetera, et cetera. It's very difficult for them to transition to a job where the key skill or one of the key skills is to admit you're wrong, to cut your losses, to be in sync with the market, to not try to force the market into your narrative, to not try to be right all the time. It's very unnatural, In many ways, I think a market maker as a C student would actually be better because they could admit they're wrong faster. Because I've seen so many people that are just so brilliant, but just could not get over that thought process, and could never become a good trader because they were always fighting it. They were always fighting the market. They always thought they were smarter than the market, and that's just not a way to make a living in this business.
I coach a few people, and these are guys who their education achievement wasn't anything special, and they went to, if they did go to university, they went to what you would call sort of, I guess, the equivalent of community colleges is what you have in the US, and they wanted to work in the markets, and they kind of went in through the back door. And some of these guys are now some of the best traders that you will ever meet. And in fact, one of them is, Jack Schrager's doing a new Market Wizards book. And I've sent some of these guys to Jack to be interviewed for the book. And there was one of them who's in that category of guy. And Jack said to me, he may just be the best trader I've ever interviewed. And
Oh,
this
wow.
is a guy who's introduced, the big names of trading. The Paul Tudor Jones, those guys are kind of the legends. And these guys are phenomenal, but they have no attachment to being right. They have no ego. They haven't come into this world with this kind of sense of I'm super smart and I need to validate that. They just come in and do what the market it needs them to do to succeed.
It's so interesting. It's so interesting. I mean, when I came in to the trading realm, like I mentioned before, I was a big reader and I was a big fan of Jack's books, and that was actually one of the things that really helped me is a lot of Jack's books, a lot of the traders would basically say what we're saying in so many words, that you have to admit you're wrong, that you're not going to fight the market's showing you a loss, get out of the position, et cetera, et cetera. That was always in the back of my mind, even though I had, high academic, pedigree or whatever you want to say. So, that helped me say, Chris, you have to admit you're wrong. And, this guy that's sitting right next to you, that's swearing to you that he's right because he's been the smartest guy in the room for his whole life, that's probably the wrong way to go about it. So that's so interesting, that you say that and to have that come out of Jack Schwager's mouth. I mean, like you said, he's interviewed, the absolute best of the best. So that's really interesting thing to say. And one more thing I'll say is, a recent book that I read, I don't know if you read this, is the new Larry Hite book, The Rule. And he's big with that. And he tells the story of, he was basically, I believe he's dyslexic, and
Yes.
he was a poor student, and he was poor at sport, and he basically, in so many words, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but like kind of failed at many things in his life. So when he got to trading, it was no like news to him that this position was wrong, right? And he was able to divorce that feeling and take his losses. And he really contributes that to a lot of his spectacular success in his life. And that was very enlightening to me as well.
Yeah, and I haven't read the book yet. I do plan to, but if you get a chance to listen to his interview, I don't know if you've heard it on Chat with Traders. He gave a brilliant interview with Aaron Fifield.
Yeah, I listened to that.
Yeah, so I mean that was great. But on what you said about some of the things you point, I'm always reminded of Warren Buffett's quote. If you want to succeed in this industry, he says if you have a 150 IQ, sell 30 points to someone else. You need to be smart, but not a genius.
Yeah, that's been my observation as well. Again, a lot of people that I started with way smarter than me and didn't achieve the success that I've achieved because they were basically too smart. I mean, they like couldn't, they should have been scientists. Like they wanted a right way. They wanted, to be correct and all that kind of stuff. So it's ironically a gift to be smart but not super smart.
Yeah. It's interesting because if I, as you're talking, and I'm sort of thinking back to some of my own experiences as a trader, and I worked in the sales side, but I was always involved more in a proprietary role. I did do some market making, but I didn't enjoy it. I wasn't particularly good at it. I think it's an undervalued skill, if I'm honest. Great market makers are just brilliant at it, and I didn't have that gift, but I enjoyed taking risk and being the one who chose the risk to put on. That's what I always preferred. And I remember, quite a long way into my career, maybe about sort of 7, 8 years, I was riding the waves of success. I was on a sharp upward trend. And then I got caught in that I'm not wrong. I mean, everyone is fallible. And I got caught in a horrendous downdraft in terms of P&L that affected me for quite a few years. And it was that suddenly believing your own publicity, believing that, it's almost like I was a victim of my own success for a while, that having, achieved some great performance, that suddenly I was better than the market. And when the market turned against me, I became one of those people, that I remember in my head saying, screw this, I'm right and the market's wrong. And the moment you ever hear yourself saying that, step away, close every position you've got, take a break. But, that is incredibly hard to do in the moment.
Totally. That's great advice, Stephen. I mean, and we're all fallible, like you say. I mean, we've all had those moments where we're really, confident, too confident, and we have a good streak. And if you let your hot streaks go to your head, you're quickly going to give it all back. And I've done that many times in my career. So yeah, that's a great lesson.
We're all human, and I mean that's I guess why you're so into the systematic side of trading. And on that score, maybe that's a good chance to bring in to introduce your book a little bit more into this conversation and tell us more about it, what motivated you to write it, and what the key philosophy or principles are that underlie it.
Absolutely. So that is a good transition. So, I'll say a couple things about the behavior stuff, because you brought it up, and just because that's what we're speaking about as well. To me, systematic trading kind of has, I think of it as a dual benefit. It could help you avoid some of the behavioral biases that we all have, me, you, and everyone else, right? I mean, this is evolution. This is, we're all ingrained with this stuff. I'm specifically speaking about, taking, selling your winners too early, holding on to your losers, having confirmation bias, anchoring, hurting, all this kind of stuff. So having a systematic process allows you to combat some of those in yourself, as well as systematically take advantage of others' behavioral mistakes as well. So to me, that's like kind of the dual benefit of having a systematic trading process. Not only that, having a systematic trading process that is rooted in behavior. I'm a big believer and fan of having strategies, and this is one of the things that the book is about. Having strategies that are, like I say, rooted in what I consider inherent human behavior. And my thought process there is, those strategies should be, sustainable and should have sustainable alpha in them and should, in theory work for decades and decades and maybe your whole life. That doesn't mean you should never change any detail about it, but those general thought processes should continue to persist, in my opinion, because human behavior is not going to change. It's not going to change in any meaningful way. This is hundreds of thousands of years that led us to this point. And we're just not going to change our behavior anytime soon. So that is juxtaposed with some strategies that are based on, let's call them structural market inefficiencies. If you could find a strategy like that, that's great. And those strategies can have extremely high Sharpe ratios and all that kind of stuff. And I would say if you could find something like that, take advantage of it. But that's probably going to go away over time. I'm not a big believer in efficient market hypothesis, but I do believe that markets are generally pretty efficient, not perfectly, and they're going to get more efficient over time. So if you have a structural inefficiency, will probably be arbitraged away and go away, whereas a behavioral inefficiency will not. So, I'm a big fan of, if you have a systematic process, it has a good back test, you didn't data mine, all this kind of stuff. That's still not enough. Like, you still want to have an explanation as to why this is occurring. What behaviors are happening on the other side that are creating this edge for you, creating this alpha for you, and grounding your strategies in those behavioral biases, is really important. So that's one of the big ideas of the book. Another big idea of the book is what we call attacking portfolio management via first principles. So me and my co-author Larry Connors came up with so first principles are things that are objectively true, things that people wouldn't really fight you on, that are self-evident. So the three first principles that we came up with for the markets is simply that markets go up, they go down, and they go through times of stress. So what we mean by that is they go up, meaning like there's a bull market, not just like in a day. They go down, meaning like there's a bear market, and then they go through times of like acute stress where there's a stressful event, And, money usually flies into safe haven assets like US Treasury bonds. So we wanted to build strategies that attack each of those first principles. And by doing that, that ties into the third big idea of the book, which is to take advantage of Ray Dalio's Holy Grail. And I don't know if you read Principles, but he calls this his Holy Grail, and that is that putting together uncorrelated strategies or alphas or asset classes, whatever, return streams into a portfolio will greatly improve the quality of the portfolio. And by quality, I mean the risk-adjusted returns of the portfolio. Said simply, if you put uncorrelated strategies together, you're going to get, the weighted average of the returns, but the risk, as far as standard deviation, is going to go down markedly because the strategies are uncorrelated. And if you, develop strategies to attack each first principle, markets go up, down, and through times of stress. They will naturally be very uncorrelated to each other, and then putting them together into a portfolio will lead to good results. So that is, in a nutshell, what the book is about. We go very deep into some of the behavioral stuff as to why we think, what kind of behavior is producing the two main market tendencies that we're taking advantage of, and that is the tendency for markets to trend over the long term and overreact and subsequently mean revert over the short term, and some of the behavioral biases behind those market tendencies. And then the book ends with four trading strategies along with exact rules, back-tested results, after you got all the theory behind it. And then we put them together into a portfolio, show the correlations, and show the end portfolio result. So that is, in a nutshell, what the Alpha Formula aims to do.
Right. Okay. And what is different about what's come out, what's come before it?
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's
Like new idea?
I mean, are
Good
you
question.
repackaging some old ideas here, or is there something that's unique about the way you presented it?
So the original idea for the book, Stephen, was that, I read a ton of trading books and everything and behavioral finance books, and I felt that there was a need in the marketplace for a combination. So meaning there's a lot of trading books that give rules and setups, and there's varying quality out there with these trading books, but there's a lot of trading books out there, and then there's a lot of behavioral finance books out there that talk about our behavioral biases and such. But I didn't see a book that really put the two together that said, here's the behavioral things that we do, here's how it can manifest itself in the marketplace, and then here's quantitative rules to take advantage of those market tendencies. So that is really the new ground, if you will, with the book, and why I thought the book should be written, because I haven't found a book that does both of those things and kind of puts them together. So that is the overarching idea of the book.
I mean, that's fascinating for me, and that's I agree with you on that, the sort of bringing these this area together. The rise of behavioral finance has been a fascinating rise for me. I've read a lot of the books out there. In fact, I lecture on behavioral finance for the Society of Technical Analysts on their diploma. And for me, I've always felt somewhere along the line, it's got to move from theory to practice. This is a nice way of bringing the two together.
Yeah, that was my exact idea, Stephen. It was like you said, I mean, I read a lot about behavioral finance as well. It's really changed my thinking, but I couldn't help but think after reading some of the books, and this is not a knock on those authors because this was not their intention or their stated goals. Okay, so but I read those books and it's like, this is awesome information, but not to be crass, but it's like, how can that make me money? How can I put that into practice? So that's why, that's what I wanted to do with this book, was really explain the behavior behind some of the market tendencies that we are trying to take advantage of. And then after the theory is that groundwork theory is put into place, putting rules around those theories to try to profit in the marketplace. So that is, the big idea of the book.
Right. Okay. So it's I'm fascinated about something here because I'm just guessing that your big advantage actually goes back 10 years, that you actually spent about 10 years in the markets, and you got to understand the markets first before then developing and moving on to this creating systems. And where I actually find a lot of systematic traders go wrong is they don't understand markets. So they come in, they analyze data, they're quantitatively very smart. They've often got a background in either data analytics or engineering or some related area. And then they think they just need to pull this together and build a system that's going to work. And
Yeah.
they then don't understand markets. And this was a point that we had with James Brodie a few weeks ago. He was a guest on, and he raised this point. I've seen it with some of the clients, that the individual I mentioned before, who has created the most awesome day trading system, actually he had, he didn't even go to university. He was a discretionary trader for a number of years, and he's kind of almost reversed into it, and then has got someone to build, work with someone and build the system based off his own ideas of how he understands markets and the way they work. And I think that's almost what was happening in Jim Simon's books. He had all those years in the markets that got him really to understand how markets work and what drives them. And he talks about, or at least the book talks about, technical analysis, human behavior, and really before they could build the system, which almost goes back to what you said earlier on.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with that more. I mean, I think that, my experience and others' experience in the markets has to be that groundwork to create strategies, right? I mean, without that, you kind of don't have anything. I think a lot of people mistakenly think that quant finance and systems trading is like just a data science and coding game, but that doesn't really make sense. I mean, it's not like if you're the best data scientist or best coder, you're going to be the best trader, right? That's not really how it works. And so yeah, I think that market experience is huge to build strategies, to have them be logical, to have a reason why you think they work, and more importantly, should continue to work going forward. And I've seen this in firsthand. I mean, my wife is a data scientist, basically. And so she works in that industry. And, I know a lot of her coworkers and I'm friends with them. And they are naturally fascinated about what I do. And I'm fascinated about what they do. But I see them. It's like they're automatically like saying, let's build these neural networks and let's do this and that without really having a structure as to here's my belief about the market, here's my market, experience, here's what I'm trying to take advantage of, those principles that you want to start with as your bedrocks to build strategies around, right? It's not just about throwing data against the wall and seeing what sticks. Which is, a lot of, data science and machine learning and other fields, you can do that, right? You could have a ton of data and you could just train the model on the data and it spits it out and it's accurate and it's good. But the markets are not like that. It's a dynamic thing that's changing all the time. And to do that data first approach as opposed to the theoretical approach and using your experience, has a lot of pitfalls. So I would caution against that, and I've seen that firsthand with some of my wife's colleagues. So yeah, it's systematic training is not a data science and coding contest. You do have to have that theoretical background, that market experience to build your strategies around.
And you have to understand risk more than anything, and
Oh yeah.
risk management, positioning, money management. Those are qualities which are often forgotten, and these people never understand those. I don't mean these people, that sounds a little bit patronizing. They haven't got experience of those yet. And it almost goes back to that first experience you had when you were in the firm, where you were standing there facing, my career's over on day one
Yeah.
if this doesn't, if it. That teaches you, like we said, something that you can never learn any other way.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, going back to what we were speaking about before, about, not really knowing the prices or where you bought and sold stuff until you're really giving the bids and offers. I mean, I view a similar thing with risk. I mean, you could see, your strategy has X standard deviation on paper and your max drawdown was Y and et cetera, et cetera. But then seeing your account go down 30% in real money terms, that's a different story, right? That you can't simulate that on paper, and that really changes you and changes your perception about risk. So, if you've never traded before and you think you could live through a 40% drawdown, no big deal because it comes back in the back test. In real life, it's not the same. So, you have to be in the market, you have to feel that pain, and that experience could be invaluable going forward.
Your book, I mean, it sounds like a fascinating book. What audience are you targeting here? I mean, are you targeting the professional audience, the retail audience, the private audience, or is it right across the spectrum?
I would say it's across the spectrum. I would say it's across the spectrum. I think a professional audience would appreciate the insights, the thought process behind, some of the strategies that we build and some of the theories behind, the behavioral based edges that we think are inherent to the marketplace. And for the kind of private crowd, I would like to portray that, having this type of thought process behind your strategies, not just over optimizing and putting together a bunch of rules that seem to work, is very important, right? You want to have theory behind what you're doing, make sure that it works well, make sure that it works across markets, across countries, all that kind of stuff, So I hope to give a deeper thought process to some of the traders who are falling into the pitfalls of over optimization and finding things that are, for lack of a better term, not real.
Yeah. I mean, it's a book that I wish, when I was young and starting out in trading, and obviously we didn't have a world like this. It was very much an open outcry world. But certainly as my career developed, I would love to have had something like this around. So it definitely sounds like there's something unique about it that hasn't been written before. Is there anything else about the book that, I mean, you talk about these first principles. That sounds like a great concept. Can you just expand on that idea of first principles?
Sure, absolutely. So, we wanted to ground our strategies in things, like I said, that no one would argue with, right? Like, no one would really argue that there's bull market phases. Like, we're in one right now, especially in the United States. No one would argue that there's bear market phases. Unless you're younger than me, you've seen that before. And in Europe, there's been bear markets, etc. And, no one would really argue that there's times when markets panic, go through stress, they freak out, right? Donald Trump tweets, or you have maybe the China-US deal fall through, or whatever it is, right? I mean, I could name so many different times throughout my career where there's been the world is ending for like a week, right? And what you see usually is, a flight to safety, a flight to high quality assets. So, our thought process was that no one's going to argue with those three principles. So if we can design strategies that profit from each of those, then they should naturally have a low correlation to each other. And that goes back to the Ray Dalio Holy Grail. Putting them together will create, a high quality portfolio. You'd get the average returns of those long, short, and panic strategies, and the risk will go down markedly. So that's what we try to show in the book. And, we go through each strategy individually. We obviously show the results, and, the results are pretty good. But I hope what the reader really sees is when we put them together, that's when really the magic happens. And that's really a key insight. Putting together a portfolio of strategies, especially if they're uncorrelated, and that goes back to, them profiting from literally different things, such as markets up, down, time to stress. Putting that together into a portfolio was really a eureka moment for me. I found that I can get sharp ratios and, results that I haven't seen Possible by single systems. Doesn't mean it's not out there, but I haven't found those results possible by just a trend following system or just a mean reversion system or just a long equity system or whatever, right? Putting those together, really creates a super high quality portfolio. And that's another thing that I would like people to take away from the book is, having uncorrelated strategies is a big deal, and it really makes the portfolio better. It makes it more robust. It makes it be able to stand up to different market conditions. And I'm not a big fan of, predicting, oh, the bull market's over, we're going to go into a bear market phase, or, we're going to panic here. You want capital allocated to each of those things because you never know when they're going to happen. So you want to have capital in place to potentially profit when either three of those things happen. So, yeah, that's kind of one of the big ideas of the book as well.
So do you have a separate pool of capital allocated to each strategy, or does money move across the strategies?
We have a separate, so in the book we show just a static percentage basis in each strategy, and that's actually what I do in real life as well.
Right.
I do some, without getting into it really, but like in real life, I do some, I measure the vol of the strategies, and if one starts to become much more volatile, I could potentially take some capital out of there. So it's a little bit dynamic, in real life, but I think having a static, portfolio allocated to each one is a very sensible thing to do.
Yeah, I guess from a pure risk management standpoint, it limits the potential damage.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Well, listen, Chris, I'm mindful of the time, and we probably need to start wrapping up this conversation. I had so many other questions that I wanted to ask you, and I think actually you've covered quite a lot of the themes that were that I wanted to bring in this. Into the conversation. I guess, I'd like to ask you a question, which I've asked quite a few of our guests at the very beginning, and I think it's quite illuminating for the audience. What three things do you wish? I'm springing this upon you, aren't I? I haven't warned you about this.
Uh-oh.
What three things do you wish you had known at the start of your career that you now know?
Oh, wow. So, off the top of my head,
Yeah, I'm sure you have different thoughts
sure.
eventually.
Yeah, right. So, I would start with what I just spoke about. It's boring to say diversification is a big deal and all that kind of stuff, but and everyone says they know that, and kind of it's intuitive, like don't put all your eggs in one basket, all that kind of stuff. But when you do the quant work and you see the results of what diversification does for you, they call it the only free lunch in investing. I mean, that is a real thing. And, I didn't have the appreciation for that when I started that I do now, right? I think when I started, and I would suspect a lot of people are like this, it's like, screw diversification. It's like I just want the best thing, right? Like, I don't need diversification. Like, I just want to put my money in the best system, the magical indicator, all that kind of stuff, and it's going to make money. But that is a faulty logic. And, I really have grown to appreciate the power of diversification. And that all leads back into what we were speaking about, Ray Dalio's Holy Grail, et cetera. The quantitative power of, and specifically the risk reducing power of diversification is really one of the main risk management tools that we have. So I wish I had a better appreciation for that when I started than I do now. So that would be one thing. Another thing I wish that I knew was, I think many other traders was searching for, kind of the Holy Grail, right? You want to search for, if I just found this indicator or this method that works, I'm just going to use that for the rest of my life and that's it, right? And then what that leads to is people being very, for lack of a better term, tribal about their method. Oh, technical analysis is the best way, trend following, value investing, buy and hold, whatever. And everyone gets into these camps. And to me, it's a faulty logic as well. I think there's many ways to skin a cat, and I think there's many things you could do in the markets that can profit over time. And you don't have to look any further than the Market Wizard's books. I mean, I've read every single one of them, and like those traders couldn't be more different in the books. I mean, some are fundamental, some are technical, some are short term, some are long term. I mean, it goes on and on and on. So finding something that works for you, that makes sense to you, that you could explain, and most importantly, that you could stick with, is the most important thing. Now, it does have to have an edge. You can't just do anything, but there's not one right way. Just because you're a value investor and I'm a trend follower or whatever, that doesn't mean I'm right and you're wrong or vice versa. So I would stop trying to search for the right way and look for the right way for yourself. So that would be another thing that I wish I knew. What would be a third thing? Yeah, I mean, a third thing would be, and this was really ingrained in me right from the beginning. And again, my experience with 2008 was instrumental in this. And that is that anything can happen, and especially as a systematic trader, you have to keep that in mind. You do your back test, you see that, okay, this strategy did fine during the tech bubble in 2000 to 2002. It did fine in the financial crisis. My max drawdown was 15%. That can't be your line in the sand. Like, you can't say, this strategy will never have a drawdown over 15% because that's what it did in the back test. Because markets will always surprise you. Things will always happen that you can't expect. So you have to take the back test with a grain of salt. You have to, bring in some wiggle room as far as, what could happen. So that's very important. And I know you asked for three, but let me just give you one more because I'm just thinking here.
Okay,
sorry, but
this one's free.
okay, this one's free. But as far as the systematic trading, I think a lot of people mistakenly want precision, and you have to get away from that. And I see that with, like I said, my wife's colleagues and others. They want to say, okay, Chris, well, you buy when whatever, let's just say an RSI is under 20. What if you did when it's under 18? Like all this kind of like very technical things of what if you change this rule? What if you change that rule? But that's not what you want to think about. You want to think about having, I forget who said it in a podcast recently, but it's like having a loose fitting suit. You want your model to generalize what's happening. You don't want to be specific because being too much being specific will just lead to fragility in the future. You want to have a robust system that generally captures the market tendency that you want to capture, right? So get away from, is a RSI under 20 or 18 better? And more go to, am I generally capturing this tendency? And does my strategy hold up over multiple different parameters? And then from there, you just have to basically pick a parameter. You have to just pick one and go with it because you never know what's going to happen and what's going to be the best one in the future. And that's another reason why I'm not a huge proponent of optimization. I think optimization can be helpful in some cases, but you can't take it as religion. You can't just optimize and say, this run was the best, so I'm going to go with this, and this is my expectations. That is really setting yourself up for failure.
Yeah, but the danger with that is always, we've analysed the data from day one to day, I don't know, 10,000, and it's great. But actually, if you start it on day two to day 10,002, it comes out with a completely different set of parameters. So, and that is so often forgotten, and that's what so many people get caught up in.
Absolutely. And I'll just expand on that with, that goes back to expectations too, Stephen, right? Like
Yeah.
if you optimize too much, you're just going to have an unrealistic expectation. And the best system is the one you can stick with, right? So if you have a expectation of this system is going to give me a three sharp ratio, whatever, and then it's not going to in real life, you're going to maybe dismiss it and stop trading it, and then you're never going to get the long-term results that you want. So it's not
Yeah.
only about over-optimizing, it's also about managing expectations as well.
Which is where the human side comes into it. It's that is the human bit. It's you cannot divorce that. As you say, we all have emotions. So you build an amazing system. It starts coming out with bum profits because you've over-optimized. And then you start thinking this isn't working. And then you take it as a reflection on yourself. And you lose trust in it and you lose faith in it. It becomes personal and then your ego gets wrapped up. So it's a whole cycle and a whole process there.
Absolutely.
Listen, this has been great. So where can our audience find out more about you?
Sure, absolutely. So my Twitter handle is at Python Trader. So feel free to follow me on Twitter. I also write for what we call the Connors Research Traders Journal, which is a free blog, if you will, and that is published on tradingmarkets.com. And so those would be the two areas to go to connect with me.
Right, okay. And where can I get hold of your book?
So the book will be on Amazon. So look on Amazon. You could also go to Trading Markets as well and buy the book. So either Trading Markets or Amazon.
Right, okay. And has that been released yet? Is it on Amazon now?
As of this second, no, but hopefully by the time this podcast comes out, it will be.
Okay, fantastic, fantastic. Well, listen, Chris, this has been great. I've actually just gone onto Twitter. For some reason, I wasn't following you, but you have a new follower.
Thank you, Stephen.
And hopefully over the next few weeks, that audience will grow. I've really enjoyed this interview. It's great to speak to somebody with such a deep perspective of the markets and all these themes.
I love this, Stephen. Thank you very much.
Wow, that's great. Sorry, Mark's not here. He would have. Mark always comes in with some fascinating views on perspectives of these, but hopefully I filled in okay on my own. And like I say, once again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today. Thank you to Chris Kane for being such an outstanding guest. This podcast was brought to you in association with the Society of Technical Analysts. You can find out more about the Society of Technical Analysts and their outstanding distance learning and diploma programs by going to their website, sta-uk.org. If you enjoyed this or any of our previous episodes, please be sure to share this with your colleagues and peers. And if you could give the podcast a rating and a review on iTunes, that will be very gratefully received. You can find out more about Alpha Mind on our website, alpha-mind.net. You can visit our blog, alphamindblog.blogspot.com, or Google Alpha Mind blog. We have a compendium of useful articles on there and information on our page links, including details of our powerful coaching program, which works with traders on trader mindset and developing the human aspects of trader performance. This is delivered both to institutions and privately to retail traders. You can also comment and follow us on social media on Twitter at AlphaMind101. We have a LinkedIn group, the AlphaMind group. That really leaves us to say just have a great week and thank you for listening.